Today's daf in Masechet Nedarim, brought to you from Yerushalayim Ir HaKedesh, is daf Ayin Aleph. And we have been oisek in an extremely difficult sugya, I have to admit. It's quite complex. It has many, many subtle issues that are involved. And that is the question of the interrelationship. In the case of a Na'ara HaMa'urasa, the interrelationship between Av and Orus. So, you know, on the surface, everything looked pretty calm and easy. I mean, even though it was a tremendous chiddush that the Torah tells us that there's such a thing as bipolar in the Dorim, and that you need to have two completely different aspects in the Hafara. And there's an interesting interrelationship in which it has to be done in tandem, and we can't have any kind of interruption, even if that interruption was subsequently legally excised through Hafara, and that was a case where we had a kiyum in between the two Hafaras. Okay, those were just opening shots across the brow of Richie's yacht. Oh, no, Richie's not even here. I can't even get him in shtach. Anyway, so we talked about the variations in cases in which there would be the death of one of the partners. So that we spoke about, the difference between Nitrokna Rishut La'av, whereas when it comes to the Baal, lo nikra, lo nitrokna reshut lebaal, we understood that that was really based on psukim, and that the idea of bina urea beit avia tells us that the default position is the position of beit avia, not beit baala. And then furthermore, the imahayot yeh, that told us that there's a hekesh between her status before the second time she gets an arus. We'll call it engaged, but everybody understands it doesn't mean engaged. Before the second engagement is the same as her situation was before the first engagement. From that, we learned the additional chiddush, which is that even in a case where the Orus had heard about the neder, even there, we have a new idea of nitrokna d'rishus of the Orus to the father. Now, this involved us in understanding a deeper level of interrelationship between the actions of the Av and the Baal. Because, first of all, we needed to understand that the act of Hafara does not seem to be a one-time act the way that the act of Hakama is. Hakama is something that once you do, what we've seen is, once you've done it, you've got a problem in undoing it unless it's through She'elah. So that, let's say, the partner, Av or Orus, who did the kiyum, dies after that kiyum, even if it's on the same day, that kiyum is done. And there's no way that we can take the place of what that kiyum was just because the person died and now say, well, now he's gone, we can go back to the father and have the father be mefer. No, that wasn't true. Masha'en kein, we understood that when it came to Hafara, we have a different situation in which the Hafara seems to be an active, continued presence of the consciousness that was Mayfair. And the moment that he dies, it is Batal, because until, of course, the moment which the two of them got together. And at that point, poof, there goes the Neder. But until such time as poof, there goes the Neder, we were able to simply cancel out through death, or for that matter, even through divorce, possibly, the hafara of the other. All right. I mean, that was a very fascinating additional pasuk. It still leaves us with a lot of questions about the nature of the impact of the hafara of one on the other, and that turned out to be a machlokas beit Shammai beit Hillel. So remember that I'm not doing this just for purposes of chazara, though that would be a good enough excuse to get back into the sugya, which is complex. I'm doing it because we're going to have reference today again back to all of those considerations that we had before, and they're going to end up making a difference in a new issue, which is introduced in this Mishnah, which we'll talk about in a moment. Man, oh man. He knows how to get you right at the worst place, right when you're most vulnerable. Right when the Ron is about to say something that's a killer, all of a sudden appears the death cup.
Rebbe has a great sense of when it's time to drink. Rebbe reaches for the bottle. And that's when Rebbe's voice starts grinding. And then Rebbe overrides it because I'm busy now, you know.
Okay, you know, well, I do that hoping that it'll put off the nemesis.
The Talmud understands the Rebbe.
Absolutely.
Okay, so we turned out that there's a very important machlokas between Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel in terms of the impact of the Hafora. So according to Beit Shammai, the Hafora actually is a 50% cut in the neder, so that in that case, it actually made a difference. And once it makes that difference, then that's the equivalent of the difference that the Hakama makes. You can't undo the neder after there's a Hakama, unless, of course, you cancel the Hakama, but that's a whole different thing. And you cannot, according to Beit Shammai, cancel a Hafara. I mean, everybody agrees you can't cancel a Hafara, right? But we said that according to Beit Hillel, you can cancel an unconsummated Hafara. What makes it unconsummated? Well, it never had a partner, because the father or the Baal did not participate, and consummation requires both of them. But according to Beit Shammai, a Hafara is never unconsummated. How is that? Because according to Beit Shammai, the way that the Hafara works is not by a sudden combination of father and Baal. The way the Hafara works is by splitting the power of the neder into two, and therefore, in the theoretical case, we would have precisely two kizesim that were usher, which was obviously a laboratory case that examines the possibility of splitting a neder literally into two so that the impacts of the neder could be traced differently to each one of the olives. So in that case, according to Beit Shammai, one olive was completely removed from the neder by one of the partners' hafara. Now, that means that the hafara doesn't really join the other person's hafara. It simply leaves half of the neder intact. But what it did, it did. And until the father comes along and takes off his half, she's still got a problem because she's got a neder on the other olive, right? But you can't say that the other partner's part was unconsummated. And now if he dies, so there goes his hafara. Not true. It's overs. That part of the neder is overs. Just as if it were entirely in the rishus of the husband, or entirely in the rishus of the father, and he would have done a hafara. Well, he could come along now and change his mind. Or if he dies, it makes absolutely no difference to us. The neder is gone. That's the whole point. Now, you understand what an amazing difference that that would make, according to the two shitot, about the nitrokna rishut la'av. Because, I mean, in a case where you have a complete hafara that was done by one partner, according to Beit Shammai, look, that hafara, that is actually a good enough hafara for me, and it allows a father to now be mefer, and it just goes over to the av. Now, it's not clear to us. What isn't clear to us is a whole new question. And that question is like this. Oh, I forgot to conclude my statement. So according to Beit Hillel, in which you have merely a chalishut of what it is that was done by the other partner, so then in the opposite case where the partner who does the hafara is the one who does not die, and the other partner is the one who dies. So let's say we have the father, he was the one who did a hafara, and the husband dies. Now the question is, what's left of that neder? Well, what's left of that neder is a very weakened neder. Because remember, according to Beit Hillel, what we have is a weakening process in which the consummation of the hafara requires the two people. Since the neder is very weakened, the question is, can it actually be inherited by the rishus of the father? And, alternatively, does it need to be inherited by the schus of the father? The difference between the two cases would be, was there a Baal at the time that had heard about the neder before he died. So that raised a different issue. Once the neder was given over into the reshus of one or the other of the parties, and then the other party hears about it, now we're back to a 50%, 50%, however it works. 50% making it weak, 50% cutting it out. So now the question is, what happens in that case? What's the difference? Oh, it's a tremendous difference. Because if we had not had the other party hear about it, then in effect, the neder was still completely within the control of one party who just needs the acquiescence of the other party, so to speak. But he doesn't even know about it. So now when the father, let's say, does his hafara and the Baal didn't even know about it, that hafara was an extremely powerful weakening of the neder because he had almost complete control of the neder, as opposed to a case where the Baal did know about it, in which case we're left with only a 50% weakening of the neder instead of an 85% weakening of the neder. Remember that all of this type of idea is nonsensical in other areas of the Torah. There's no such thing as percentages. The question is something batal or is something not batal? And it's always an issue of yes or no. We don't get to the question of weakening, and therefore, since you didn't have the full iser, it's partially batal, and therefore you won't get malchus because it was batal. It's either it is batal or it's not batal. But remember that when it comes to the, I mean, of course, the Rabbanan can make it usher, but then you won't get malchus. I mean, that idea from the Rabbanan is a completely different issue. Here we're talking about Minoraisa. So the question is, I mean, how does this work? The entire thing seems weird. So as we pointed out, that's why Nara Hamurasa is so weird. It's weird because it's an added weirdness to the, I use the word weird, by the way, because the Rishonim used the word weird. Remember, back at the beginning of the Masechet, we pointed out that the Lashon of the Rishonim is that Nedarim is weird, and that the language that we find used in Nedarim departs from the standards of the way it's used in other Masechtas. We had a lot of discussion about why that's true. But underlying all of the practical considerations as to how that came about historically, which was the breaking down of Ataras Nedarim in Bavel because of government interference, the question of whether the Masechet was allowed to be learned, those are historical issues as to the mechanisms. But the underlying reality that Masechet Nedarim itself is a discussion of states of mind and its relationship to language obviously is going to make it weird. And the weirdest place of all is the interrelationship between father and incipient husband in the case of a Nara HaMu'urasa. And remember that the Nara HaMu'urasa has special dinim across the entire Torah, in terms of her special status, like the onshim of Eshes Ish and so on. It's not surprising that we need to deal with the special situation of the way in which the mind of the Nara HaMu'urasa works, which comes out in the Mishnah that we're going to have that we already discussed, about whether once there's a complete dependency on an Oros, whether that Oros can even be Mevatel himself and be made for her Nedarim, because he's ipso facto a Baal, because she's dependent on him. That's all questions of states of mind, the Ritzon Baala, and so on. So over here, because of the confusion, and everybody knows about the confusion of puberty, everybody knows about the confusion of teenagers, and that is a biological fact. It's not just a strange kind of thing that is part of a transition that is psychological. It has to do with the actual rewiring of the brain. It's not something to be laughed at and we can just get over by flicking our fingers. So the fact that the Torah puts that specific element, there is no place in the Torah where we have a description of the unique transitional period of puberty so clearly as the concept of a Nara. Everything else is defined by a time and a biological change. The state of Naharut is defined by how much time has passed since the hormonal changes of puberty began. That's the only way it's measured. There's no external measurement of it. We can't see it. Maybe in an MRI we could, but we can't see it as we can the transition between katnus and godless. That's something else. Okay, those are hormonal changes that affect not mind, but that affect body very clearly, and that of course, will affect mine. So over here we have something that's absolutely unique in terms of its measurement of psychology that the Torah introduces with a completely new type of shear. When does a woman become a bogeret? 6 months to the day from the time of the onset of puberty. What a weird kind of concept, right? Okay, so then that means that we have over here an analysis of how she interrelates in her mind between Av and Baal. So we've learned a number of very important dinim, which are going to have to do not just with how she interrelates, but what happens when one of them is taken out of the picture, which is much more complex. If the father dies, if the Orus dies, if the Orus divorces her, how about if she gets remarried after she made the neder? There was an original Orus. What happens then? Does the relationship with her second Orus, does he inherit the rights of the first Orus? Does, when we had the Pasuk of Hayoti Yeh, what does that mean about cases where that second Orus is in a position of a first Orus who died? And we talked about, what about if the first Orus heard was Begarish? We raised that issue yesterday, whether the Gerishin per se is going to be the equivalent of a Hakoma. Well, it's also an issue. So all of these things we need to take into consideration, and it's our Mishnah that introduces this new factor. So we've had until now the very complex interrelationship, the changes that come from the death of the Baal or the Orus, but we never discussed the issue of what happens when there is a second Orus who takes the place of an original Orus who had heard about it. And what happens then? Because then we're not only interested in whether Nitrokna Roshus La'av or Nitrokna Roshus La'baal, that's relatively clear. But do we say that the father once again is mefer the Nedarim together with the second Orus? Or are the Nedarim that had already been heard by the first Orus, which were Nitrokna Roshus La'av, are they back again in the Roshus of the second Orus? Are they removed from the Shurus of the father? I mean, those are two different things. They might be removed from the Rishus of the father, and he cannot be Mefer on his own, but there's no second Orus to take the place of the original Orus because the original Orus already heard about it. So then nobody can be Mefer. That's also a possibility. In any event, our Mishnah raises these issues in a subtle way, as we will see. Nadra v'hi arusa, says the Mishnah. So she goes ahead, and she makes her neder. Everything seems fine. She's got a husband and she's got a father. And then he divorces her. He divorces her on the same day. Same day as what? What's the same day mean? The same day that he heard? Or the same day that daddy heard? Because that makes a big difference, doesn't it? If the problem in the Mishnah is that the reason that we need to say the same day is because if it's the next day, then how is daddy going to be made for the next day when there's a new Orus? That's one thing. That's obvious. You can't be made for in the day after you heard. You can only be made for in the day you did hear. But what if the same day is because it has to be the same day that the Orus heard, not the same day that daddy heard? Uh-oh. Now, if that's the case, it raises a whole series of serious issues. Because if it means that it was the same day that the original Orus heard, then that seems to imply that the second Orus takes the place of the first Orus, and that therefore he is limited to the day that the Orus heard. So if he becomes now the new husband in the last 5 minutes of the day that the original husband had heard and divorced her, so then he's only got 5 minutes. But he does have 5 minutes, it would appear. But that would mean that Orus number two would be made for together with the Av. Now, those are two very different ways of learning the Mishnah, and we don't really know what the Mishnah means. So again, Rabbeinu HaKadosh has done a fabulous job of confusing us, forcing us to confront the issues, and leaving us dangling until we work it out, which, of course, leaves the door open to more and more differences of opinions. Okay. That's why Nedarim is bechlal interesting. So, so So she becomes Megureshet on that day. And then she becomes re-engaged somebody new on the same day. Now, this is a rather prolific little girl. She does this 100 times, you know. They find out about her very quickly. We've got all the gets, you know, in the Beis HaSofer. Oh, boy, this guy's going to be back in 5 minutes. Better write the get and be ready for just putting in the names. Okay. So anyway, she does this 100 times. All her old boyfriends are waiting in line, you know, for the next one to fall. So she does this afilu lemea. The din is that avia uba'ala ha'acharon mefirin nidareo. Now, again, we don't know whether that means that we're talking about a case where the previous orus knew about it, or we're talking about a case where the previous orus had no idea that she had nidareo. So, zakla. Basically, the way to understand this is that as long as there wasn't a single moment in which her father had lost the rights to her, what would that mean? Well, that would mean that before the guy divorced her, for instance, he took her to the chuppah, and he only divorced her after going to the chuppah, so now she was a nesua. But the moment she was a nesua, even for one moment, the father is no longer ever able to recoup his power over her, because once she was yatzer mirshut ha'av, she was completely yatzer mirshut ha'av. So zeklal, kol shelo yatzal lirshut atzma sha'achat avia ubala acharon mefirin nidareha. Now, it turns out that Shmuel, as we are going to see, had a Kabbalah from his rabbein that the reason that this Mishnah said bo bayom was not because the father needed to hear and because he had already heard bo bayom. It's because the original orus had heard. And that's why number 99 has to actually get there in time to be made for the Nadarim, because number 1 had already heard. So this is why they don't talk about bottles of beer on the wall. They talk about orusim. You know, this is what happens to people who get a little bit too much into Nadarim. So even their drinking songs change.
What taxi should you not take to a wedding, which obviously hers did? Get taxi.
Oh my gosh. He worked the entire time on that one.
Which I've had it for 2 years.
Okay. I mean, you make Winston Churchill look like a nobody. He used to plan his jokes only a few months in advance, and they looked entirely extemporaneous. All right. So,
just a question: if the artist or the father haven't heard about it, how much time do they have to hear about it?
Unlimited. As long as she's still in their rishus. It only is a function of the day that they hear. So now, the Gemara says, and I am making a mistake, the Gemara does not say the next statement. It turns out that the author of the next statement, and the Ron gives examples of this in other places, where the Gemara seems to be saying something, but it's really part of the statement that follows and can't be understood on its own, such as this. Minol on the orus achron mefer nidorim shenir'u la'orus rishon. How do we know that Mr. 99, or for that matter, Mr. 2, can actually be mefer together with the av, a neder that was already heard by orus number 1? How do we know that? Excuse me? We don't know that. What do you mean, how do we know that? That means that the statement of how do we know that is part of the chiddush of what the Mandi Amar is saying. Omar Shmuel, I'll tell you how we know it. So it sounds like first we know it, and then Shmuel is telling us how we know it. But the truth is, this is Shmuel sneakily sticking in his Kabbalah. How do we know? Oh, you say we don't know. Well, I'll tell you. I have a Kabbalah from my Rebbe that we do know, and that the reason that the Mishnah mentioned that it has to be Bo Bayom was because of the fact that the original Orus had already heard of it, which means that the Mishnah is asserting that even though the original Orus heard of it, still the second Orus is made for together with the father. You've heard all of that between the lines, right? Okay, so anyway, I'm asking you, how do we know that? So it's actually all a function of Shmuel, as we're going to see. So Shmuel, who's telling us how we know it, is also informing us that we do know it. But of course, as all of us have been guilty, we pretend that, well, of course, we're all agreed that, so how do we know? Which usually fools the other person into thinking, yeah, we do know. How do we know? All right. So this is what Shmuel is actually doing over here, right? All right. So Shmuel says, I'll tell you how we know it. Omar kra, v'im hayot yeh le'ish unedorea aleha, tells us that even though these nedorim were on her before, and therefore they could still be mufar by the second orus. Huh? Ah, oh, come on. There's a limit to how much fakery we're going to tolerate from Shmuel. And it's the old pasuk. We know that pasuk. Don't come along and tell me. The pasuk is telling me not only that the father, in this case, this Roknum Rishus La'av, it's teaching me that a second orus can go ahead and take the place of a first orus. Whoa. Where do you see that? That's entirely a fake, says the Gemara. What? I mean, Dilma Hani Mila should know Lo Niru Loris Vishonim. Isn't that the whole point? You're claiming, Shmuel, that the Mishnah is teaching us that if there was a Shmi'ah by the original Orus, that if he's out of the picture, even so, Orus number two starts the whole thing over again. Well, where the heck does that pasuk say this? It doesn't say that. It says exactly the opposite. We said, Ima Yoti Yeh means that the father gets the reshus. Now you're telling me, yeah, the father gets the reshus, but it goes back to the orus when there's a new orus. Where do you see that? So obviously this is only referring to a case which I already know, where lo nir ula orus rishon. Masha enke nidorim that were nir ula orus rishon. I would say, lo matzimei for orus acharon. Where in this pasuk do you see otherwise? Ah, says Shmuel, I'm telling you a brand new idea. The word aleha. Now, you never thought about that word, did you? Why did it have to say in this pasuk, nidorea aleha? After all, let's take a look. What does the pasuk say? V'ima yoti yeh le'ish unidorea aleha. O mifta sifatea asher asra al nafsha. Yeah. Well, don't you need to repeat aleha? I mean, O miftas fata asher asra al nafsha aleha? How come you don't need to say aleha in the second phrase, and you needed to say aleha in the first phrase? Yeah, no, I know you could tell me that the second phrase is going back on the original aleha. Now let's imagine if we took out the word aleha. So how would we read the pasuk? Well, imayati yeleish, together with nidoreha, o miftas fata asher asra al nafsha, without the word aleha. So would I not know right then and there that the halacha would be that the orus together with the av can be mefer? Yes. Would I not know that if the orus dies, that hayotiyeh means it goes back nidroklon reshus la'av? Yes. So why, says Shmuel, if we would know all of that without aleha, why do you think the Torah says aleha? Because what it means is anything aleha. That's the point. So even if this aleha was the type of neder that was already heard by the second orus, I still say that the father and the orus can be made for her nedarim. There you go. That's what I was saying. So you worked a little harder to understand what I'm saying, but now we can go back and see the whole thing in context. I have a Kabbalah, the Lashon of the Mishnah, that insists that it needs to be the same day, is not because of what you would have assumed, because daddy has to be made for the same day. That's obvious. The Mishnah is not coming to tell you the obvious. It's coming to tell you something brilliantly new. And I'm going to explain to you how we know it. But the brilliantly new is that even though, now see how this is part of our original discussion of what does it mean when we say that the Orus is given the permission to go ahead and to be mefer. And we had all of those questions before. Is the primary mover of the hafara of the neder the father? And it's only because of the fact that the Torah insists on giving the baal, maybe that insistence was merely the right of refusal. meaning that he can be make him, and that would prevent the father. Remember, we had that question before, way back at the beginning of the parak, where we were considering, what does it mean? How do we understand the interrelationship of the vav, of the ve'im hayotiyeh, with the fact that the pasuk only mentions the baal's hakama? Why is that? So that was all part of our original confusion about how does this interreact, the father and the oros. And this gives us an entirely new issue to contend with. Is an oros an individual who is empowered, or is an oros a foil to the father? How do we know that the second oros gets right? Now let's think for a moment. This is what Shmuel is saying. Let's think for a moment. What does Shmuel mean? What would have been the case where, if we didn't have that extra pasuk oleha, what would be the situation of a nara murasa whose current oros heard about the neder and then dies? The current oros hears about the neder and is megarish. So, okay, the normal case would be, we said that this was part of the nitrok nala'av issue before. We said it would be nitrok nareshut la'av. We learned that out from Yimayotiyeh. So that if there's a second oros, and now the Torah is mechadish, there's aleha, what is the din? Is the din, if we wouldn't have had the idea in the Mishnah of avia uba'alaha acharon mefir nidareha, what would have been the din? That the second oros prevents the av from being mefer on his own, because the very fact that she now has a baal means the father cannot be mefer on his own. It might just mean that. And therefore, no one could be mefer. I wouldn't have known that the second oros can be mefer with the father. On the other hand, I wouldn't have said nisrok and rishus la'av, since there is an oros, right? So I would have been left without understanding whether the father is mefer on his own because of the hekesh of ayotiyeh, or whether perhaps nobody can be mefer. The second oros can't be mefer because I never heard in the Torah that an oros can be yoresh another oros. On the other hand, I never saw in the Torah that a nara hamu'urasa, a father, could possibly mefer on his own where there is an oros, and I wouldn't be sure. Since the Torah did say that even if the nedarim were pre-existing, they still are taken away from the father's soul rishos and given to an oros, what would be the din of nedarim that were pre-existing but belong to another oros? So that would open up a whole can of worms. I don't know. Where does the Torah address that issue? Comes along Shmuel to say it does indeed. And the relationship to an oros is essentially a generic relationship. So that the question of who it is irrelevant to this child. She just knows that she's engaged. And this is very much in line of the way that the Torah views the relationship of a woman to marriage. She doesn't care who she's engaged to. She just wants to be engaged. That's the point. And that's the concept of Tav Lametav Tandu, Milametav Armalata. And therefore, in giving over the rights to the second Oros, you know, what's the difference? Flip the pictures and just, you know, use your Photoshop and stick in the face of the new Oros. I mean, does it really matter, you know, this romantic moment of giving me, you know, that beautiful gift and so on. And so now it's the second guy. I mean, it's all the same picture. Actually, I like the first pictures better. So we'll just stick in his face instead of that face. So that, well, okay. So then that would mean that the second oros is actually in place of the first oros. So this is what Shmuel is saying. How can we know whether Shmuel is right? There's no indication in the Mishnah. The Mishnah leaves us hanging. I'm not sure whether it just stipulates it has to be on the same day because daddy heard, and therefore he won't be able to go and be mefer if it's after today, or the reason that it says the same day is because oros heard, and therefore the second oros will be unable to be mefer because time's run out. Sorry. So Shmuel is insisting that the Mishnah is talking about a case where the Oros is heard, not that the father is heard. Where do we see that? Well, Tanik Avazid Shmuel. Fact is, we have a riot to Shmuel from the Braita, which makes it clear where the Mishnah does not make it clear. So you see why we cannot bring a raya to Shmuel from the Mishnah. That's the whole point. If Shmuel was talking about a diak in the Mishnah when he said, and how do we know that an Oros, right, and it wasn't just his own Chiddush or his own Kabbalah, it would be ridiculous to say, let's bring a raya from a braisa to Shmuel. What? We just learned that from the Mishnah. So obviously the Gemara understands, no, we did not learn anything from the Mishnah. We were just listening to Shmuel's assertion about the Mishnah. Now show me that Shmuel's assertion is correct. That's what we're about to do now by bringing the braita. So, Tanya Kavasi to Shmuel. So where do we see from a braita that indeed a second Oros takes over the status of the original Oros? Well, the braita says like this. Okay, that's the classic statement which begins the entire saga of our perek. Now comes along the braita to expand. Ketzad. Well, let's talk about a case, says the braita, where Shama Avia, daddy hears, and he did the hafara. And the Baal didn't even hear about it, and he dies. Lo yispika Baal ishmoa at shemit. And then she gets another Baal, Ninitarsa bo bayom, and he dies too. And this happens 100 times. I mean, you'd think that number 3 would understand that he's dealing with a black widow spider, but all right. Anyway, so she does this 100 times. And now, how would we know that Avia Ubaalah Acharon Mefirin Nidarea? That's what Shmuel was coming to say. And it says over here that this is the case now. And it says, however, only a case where lo speak up Baal Lishmoa. Uh-oh, now, that's not like Shmuel. Remember, the whole Kiddush of Shmuel was, how do we know, even in a case where the original Baal did hear? So far, if anything, the Braita is telling us the opposite of Shmuel. Okay, so how do we get to the Raya to Shmuel? Well, let's continue. Shama Ba'alah Ve'ferla. How about the opposite case? Where the husband actually heard and did the hafara, and then he dies. And he dies before her father ever heard about it. So, lo yispika av lishmoa ad shemet ha-baal, chozer ha-av u-mefer chelko shel baal. The father now, I mean, obviously, he has to be made for his own part, because he never even heard about it before, but he needs to go and be made for what it was that the baal was already made for. Why? Because remember, what we say is that a hafara, which has not been consummated, needs, after the death of the person who made the hafara disappears because it was never consummated. And therefore, the father has to come back and he has to redo the hafara of the Baal. Now, never been consummated? According to whom was it never consummated? So here we get into what appears to be very different from everything that we ever thought, and therefore becomes a lengthy exposition of the Ran as to why this is not a contradiction to what we've been saying. Omar Rabbi Natan, this is only true according to Beit Shammai. Why is that? Because after all, Beit Shammai has one idea of the nature of Hafar. But according to Beit Hillel, the father would be unable to be Mefer. Now, why would that be? So let's think about first. The Av has to be Chozer Mefer Chalko Shobal. And he can be, even though she already has a new Orus. And we'll see why that's true. That is going to be Mefer Chalko of the original Baal. But the point over here is when it says that he has to go back and be made for the Chelik of the Baal, first of all, as we've said, that obviously means he has to be made for his own Chelik, that he never did it before. So that he has to do. The Chiddush over here is that even though the husband was already made for his Chelik, the father comes back and he is made for the Chelik of the Baal as well. Why is that? Because when the Baal dies, his hafara is bottle. Okay, and now we're saying that that's true. I'll leave it to Beit Shammai. Avo Beit Hillel Umrim, no, Eino yochol lahafer. The father cannot be mefer the chelek of the Baal. He needs to have the orus, the new orus, in order to be mefer. Okay, why is this? So what we're saying is that according to Beit Shammai, nedarim that were already in the reshus of the original orus are now left completely in the reshus of the father, even though there is a new orus. And therefore, even though this particular neder, the orus that exists now is irrelevant. Why is he irrelevant? He's irrelevant because of the fact that the original orus, in this case, had already been mefer. We'll see why that's true. And therefore, you would say that, all right, but maybe the orus ha'acharon, he's not there any longer. But remember, the only time that we can give the reshus of the right stafara is in a case of nedarim that had never been in the reshus of the original orus. But maybe if they were in the reshus of the original orus, they cannot be given. Well, that we know that's not true. Even if they had been in the reshus, they end up being nitrokno reshus la'av. So if that's the case, even though over here orus number one already knew, and the death of orus number one means that his hafara is canceled, because the moment that he dies, it's canceled. So therefore, when we have the second orus, he has no place at all, and we'll see why. This part is really strange. But even though he has no place at all, the father can be mefer. So why is this? Claims the Gemara, and the Ran says, this is wild. What does this have to do with the previous machlokas? B'mai plige. And once again, we get to the same machlokas, Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel. Beit Shammai savre nedorim nami shiro uilo orus. Nitrok na reshut la'av, umegiz gayez, and Beit Hillel savre, avia uba'ala acharon, mefirin nidareah, velo megiz gayez. So for some reason, we're sticking in the question about whether this is an absolute cancellation or whether it's a weakening into this question itself. Okay, so now this becomes the problem. And I'm going to tell you how the Ran understands the sugya. Let's go back to the beginning, where it says over here that if Shama Avia Vefer Lavaloi speak abalishmoa achemet, and now Nitarsa Biyom. So what's if it's on the same day? Avia Ubala Acharon Mefir Nidorea. Now, the Ran wants to explain the sugya according to all of those Rishonim who claim that there is no machlokas Beit Shammai Beit Hillel about this opening case. Everybody would agree. And the only machlokat Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel is in the second case. There is where we get into the problems, which, says the Ran, doesn't make any sense. Because if we're going to relate this question, and we need to go over this because it will clarify all of the things that we were talking about before in terms of Megiz Gaius, Miklash Kalash, and Sani, so on. So the Ran is very bothered. He says it doesn't seem to make any sense, because according to Beit Hillel, we said that Beit Hillel holds Miklash Kolish. So that means that once the father had heard, and he was Mayfair, he has been seriously machlish this neder. Why? Because he isn't the one who died. It was the husband who died. And therefore, there was no change in the status of his unilateral hafara without there being a knowledge on the part of the husband, and that never became botel. So if that's the case, didn't we learn before that in a case where the father had been mefer, before we got into this whole complication of there being a second orus, didn't we say before that in the event that her father heard, he did the hafara, and the Baal didn't even hear before dying, that in that case we said the av cannot be mefer? And we don't say that nitrok nereshut la'av because the neder has been weakened, according to Beit Hillel. And a weakened neder, according to Beit Hillel, is not passed back to the father. It's only a full neder that can be passed back to the father. That's what we said before. In that case, we don't say nitroku l'shut la'av. Because once the neder has been weakened, it's not valuable enough. It doesn't have the power. It's only a 15% neder. We're not going to give that back to the father because there's no way to be morish that. So why isn't that an issue over here, asks the Ran. Why don't we say that this case, which now inserts a new variant, what is that? There's a second Oros. Okay, what are you going to say? The second Oros is going to inherit the rights from the first Oros? Which rights? To a 15% neder? Doesn't Beit Hillel hold that a 15% neder does not ever pass back to the Rishus of the father? Why then should it pass back to the Rishus of the Oros? And I think I understand what they're saying. Namely, that in a case where we have to be mitrokein Rishut La'av, that in that case, we have to take it out of the rishus of the oros and put it into the rishus of the husband, of the father, right? In this case, however, the whole point of this argument is that the second oros is simply a generic replacement for the first oros. It is not a function of his inheriting rights from anybody. We don't take it away from the first Oros and give it to the second Oros. We simply pop in the photoshopped picture of Oros number two into the picture of Oros number one, and therefore who cares what's left of the neder? That would mean that the issue of Megiz Gaiz or Miklash Kolish is irrelevant. That must be what they hold. That there's a fundamental difference in that an Oros can be taken over by another Oros, no matter what it is that the neder is. Masha Enken going back into the Rishus of the father, that requires us to remove it from the Rishus of Orusim, whoever they are, into the Rishus of the Baal. And that's what Beit Hillel was saying before. We cannot do that unless we actually have a real neder to change the Rishus over. Chaim, Gavi's not helping out today. No, nothing in there. He thinks I'm being fooled. Fine. So this is now introducing a whole new concept. Oros taking place of Oros. The language that the Ran uses is, he stands in his shoes. That's the point. And that is Kikare Derishon. He becomes the feet of the original Oros because we photoshopped the head. And the feet, we understand, are generic enough. Okay. Now, when we get to the second case, here the Oros heard about it and he was made for it. And what happens is that the Av comes about and he is made for Chalko Shobal. And now, for some reason, we have introduced again Miges Gaius. Says the Ran, now I'm really confused. Why do we say that according to Beit Shammai, that Nedorim that were seen by the first Oros go back to the Rishus of the Av, and therefore it's Megiz Gaiz? What does Megiz Gaiz have to do with it? We're saying that the Oros is out of the picture, according to Beit Shammai, and the father can do this on his own. Says the Ran, I have no idea. What does this have to do with Megiz Gaiz? We're saying that according to Beit Shammai, the father is the only one who can do this afar, and he does not need anybody else. Why does that have something to do with Megiz Gaiz any more than Beis Hillel, who holds Miklash Kolish? This is not about inheritance. So where does it get into the picture at all? Because furthermore, the moment that the husband died, didn't we see before that the moment that the husband dies, the Oros dies, that the idea is that even the father's hafora is kaput. It disappears. Now, if you're going to tell me that the hafora was still around, why would the Baal not be able to be mefer? Remember that everybody agrees to that, right? That wasn't a machlokas between Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel. Everybody agreed. Daddy goes ahead. He does his afora. Now he dies. Does that have anything to do with the Megiz Gaiz or Miklash Kolish? You'll say, yeah, actually it should. Because according to Beit Shammai, who says that it's all a question of taking off half of the neder, So then wouldn't it mean that even though daddy died, what he did was already done? That's what I thought we were saying before. Now I realize, that wasn't true. Because if it were true, why can't the Baal say, okay, and now I'm taking off my part? Without Nitrok Narishus, I don't need Nitrok Narishus. Daddy took off what he can. I don't care if he's around or not. That's done. But Beit Shammai agrees that no, it's not done. And in that case, as the Mishnah said, without any machlokas, we do not say Nikrot Narishus Labal. And if you're going to tell me that the meaning of Megis Gaius is that once one partner does the Rishus, like we were talking about before, which is a mistake that I made, says the Ran apparently. If you're going to tell me that Megis Gaius makes the difference as to whether what the partner did remains even though he dies, so then why indeed would we say that the Baal should not be able to give his part of the action without any Nitrog? I don't need the father's part. The father did his part. That share is over. Don't give me any more rights than I had before. I'm perfectly happy. I will now be made for my part. And I can't do that, according to anybody, even Beit Shammai. Nobody ever discussed that question. It was never an option. So what that means is that we do not say that Megis Gaius means that each partner finishes off his part and now go happily to the grave without wondering about what happens to the netter. It's done. Not done. Uh-oh. So then you have no choice but to bite the bullet, says the Ran, that even if you hold like Beit Shammai and Megis Gaius, that does not mean that we do not need the continued presence of your mind to make that Megis Gaius happen prior to the consummation of the complete bittul of the neder. So we were wrong in what we thought before, okay? So if that's the case, then it's true here as well. If the partner died, why does the Gemara make it dependent in Megis Gaius? That makes no sense to me. How does Beit Shammai's opinion about Megis Gaius affect his opinion about whether the father can or cannot be made for the neder all on his own without the Orus HaAcharon? That's what I need to understand. Says the Ran, this is part of what it is that we understood before about the nature of the second Orus taking the place of the first Orus without a question of inheritance being the issue. Because what happens over here is, you're 100% right. When the Orus dies, his impact upon the neder is zilch. True. True. And nonetheless, the Gemara is asserting that the idea of Megis Gaius is nonetheless relevant. How? By the following logic. If Orus number 2 is actually taking the place of Orus number 1, what does that mean? It means that whatever was given, the rights to an Orus, is to him. But what if the Orus already exercised those rights? Barry, you're falling asleep. And the more complex this is, the more exciting it is. What if the Orus already exercised his rights? So you'll say, yes, but when he died, his exercise was finished, and the jinn even gave back to his surviving wife the remainder. They never did that. But let's say, so why can't the second Orus now take his place? That's because there's nothing left to give the second Orus. The rights of the Orus have been exercised, period. So you'll say, what do you mean they've been exercised? The neder is still here. I don't give a hang if the neder is there. The Orus isn't inheriting the neder. He is taking the place of the rights to be mevatel the neder. And that was the rights of a person who already used up those rights. So you'll say, what a waste. He used up those rights and then he went ahead and died. So now we didn't have any impact on the neder. It's truly sad. Thank you very much. But that doesn't give you rights. You can sit there and bemoan the fact that, well, why did he have to exercise those rights before dying? He shouldn't have. Yes, it's right. He shouldn't have had his final pizza pie either. But it's completely irrelevant to the point. That's the Chiddush, says the Ran, is that we need to distinguish further between the meaning of the exercise of rights versus the simple fact of the relationship of the netter to those rights. That's what I understand is the only meaning of the Gemara if we are going to follow the approach that I've been taking, which is that the first statement was true both according to Beit Shammai and according to Beit Hillel. So that would be amazing. On the other hand, the Beit Hillel holds that Avihu Ba'alah Acharon Mefirin Nidoreha. That's because the implications of Miklash Kolish, as opposed to Megas Gaias, is that I never exercise the rights. That's the point. The rights are exercised only at a time that they are consummated. Well, you can't consummate things all on your own. And therefore, the second Arus simply takes the place of the first Arus. What do you mean he already used the rights? You don't use the rights. Because weakening things is not the real use of the rights. It's weakening through consummation and destroying. That's the rights. And that was never used. So that means that this has application even according to the way Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai understand the issue about another question entirely. So now we have extended the question of Megas Gaias versus Miklash Kolish to a totally new area. Not that it's nogea, the inheritance of the rights to the netter and the possibility of giving over those rights to another partner. Rather, it has to do with the definition of how does one exercise those rights and what uses them up. So if you're Megas Gaias, you can use them up. If you're Maklish Kolish, you're not using them up. You're waiting, so to speak, for your partner to complete this act of hafara. That makes all the difference in the world. Now, the one question that's been left to us, says the Gemara, is we've been talking about the death of the Aras, but we were raising in the Mishnah the issue of the divorce. Now, we said that we're going to prove the relationship of Shmuel's understanding of the Mishnah to this Braita. This Braita is talking about every one of the Arusim die. So, in that case, is death and Gerishin the same? Because one way of looking at it is, if the person goes ahead, this Arus, and he divorces her after hearing about it, and he does not say, I want to be Mefer, then the fact that he goes ahead and gives her a get, is that a passive hakama? Because the fact is that if the person knows that he's got 5 minutes of consciousness left, Baruch Avram, it's 5 minutes till the end of the day. This is his last opportunity to be Mefer, and he's not Mefer. What does that do? It creates a hakama through default, right? Well, how about if the guy knows, okay, we've got 5 minutes left till this get takes effect. I'm about to hand it to her. So then that gives me 5 minutes to be made for her netter. Well, I don't give a hang about her netter. Uh-huh. So then what you've done in giving the get is ending the day, because the get is the remains of the day and you didn't do anything. So that should be a passive hakama. Is it? Well, that changes the equation very much in terms of the Nisrok Nereshus La'av, if you already did a hakama, right? So what would be the din? Iboilu. Now, obviously, this has to do with the discussion that we just had. So Gerishin, how do we view Gerishin? Is Gerishin the equivalent of a passive hakama in which it's kishtika? Or is it a kishtika at the end of the day, in which case it's real hakama? So how do we look at it? Is it just being quiet in the middle of the day? Or is it the equivalent of hakama? Well, what would be the din? What's the difference? Oh, big difference. Let's imagine a case like this. Let's imagine a case in which her husband, meaning the Oros, hears about it. He gives her a get, and he takes her back on the same day. Now, if you're going to tell me that this was just passive aggression, so then he has not been making, and now he has the remains of the day to continue to go ahead and to be Mefer. But if you're going to tell me, no, this is actually active aggression, because in the act of gerushin, he's making it really clear that he wants this netter to stick around and let her suffer. So then there'd be no way. Then lomatzi mefer. What do you say? That will leave you at the edge of your chair, which will be terrible for Baruch Avram. Won't be able to sleep all day, being at the end of, you managed to sleep at the edge of a chair too? Oh my gosh. So this will leave you at the edge of your chair, and let us see whether we can bring a raya from all of the discussions that we've had until now to the question of how we view passive aggression versus active aggression in a relationship between an arusa who is about to get divorced, and then the guy changes his mind and takes her back on the very same day of giving her the divorce. These are really tough kind of engagements, but these are the kind of things that happen all the time. As a matter of fact, as Aram points out, why are we talking about his taking her back? Couldn't we talk about somebody else taking her? Yeah, but we want to talk about normal cases, says the Ram. Normal cases. Well, they got into a big fight. He gives her a get, and then he says, I'm sorry, honey. So let's start all over again. Oh, my gosh. So you can see how deeply this whole sugya is involved in the norms of human strange interconnections on their way to marriage. All right, so Bezrat Hashem, if the good Lord spares us, we will hopefully be zeicha tomorrow once again to learn. And of course, those who want to use the time for Sesame Street will have the best time looking during Daf Yomi at that which gives them so much joy. We wish you a wonderful day, and we should hear Besirot Tovot. Kol Tov, everyone.